This program is copyright 1995 by National Vanguard Books. Post Office Box 330, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946. All rights reserved.
The electronics manufacturer we hit in Racine wasn't very big, but he was a sole supplier of certain key components for other manufacturers all across the country. By torching his plant, we eventually caused 20 others to shut down. The effects of these actions are not decisive yet, but if we can keep it up, they will be. The public reaction has already convinced us of that. That reaction can certainly not be considered friendly to us on the whole. In Houston, a mob took two prisoners, suspects arrested for questioning in one of the bombings, away from the police and tore them limb from limb. Fortunately, they were not our people, just two hapless fellows who were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the conservatives, of course, have redoubled their squawking and cackling that we're ruining all chances for an improvement in conditions by provoking the government with our violence. What the conservatives mean when they talk of an improvement is a stabilization of the economy and another round of concessions to the blacks, so that everyone can return to consuming in multiracial comfort. But we learned long ago not to count our enemies, only our friends, and the number of the latter is growing now. Henry indicated that we have increased nearly 50% in membership since last summer. Apparently, our new strategy has knocked a lot of spectators off the fence, some on our side and some on the other. Perceptive people are beginning to realize that they won't be able to sit this war out. We are forcing them into the front lines, where they must choose sides and participate, whether they like it or not. The next diary entry is dated March 28, 1993. I'm finally back in the swing of things now. Over the weekend, Catherine answered many questions for me and gave me the details, especially about local developments, which I failed to get from Henry Friday. While I was locked up, the work on our communications equipment had to go on, of course, and now there are two other well-qualified people in the area handling that task. But there's still plenty of technical work left for me. Bill is a fine mechanical craftsman and gunsmith, but he can't handle the ordnance jobs that require chemical or electronic techniques. He gave me a long list of requests for special devices which came into our unit while I was in prison and which he had been obliged to put aside. We went over the list carefully last night and decided which items are most important for the current needs of the organization. I then made up my own list of supplies and equipment needed to begin work. The top priority items on Bill's list of requests are radio-controlled detonators and time-delayed detonators and igniters. The organization has been improvising in the latter category and getting too high a percentage of misfires. We want a time-delayed device which is adjustable from a few minutes to a day or more and which is 100% certain. Another category of items requested is disguised bombs and incendiary devices. It is now just about impossible to get into any government or media facility without walking through a metal detector, and all packages and mail are routinely scanned by X-ray. This will require some cleverness, but I already have a few ideas. And then there is Bill's own project, on which he needs some technical assistance. Counterfeiting. The organization is already successfully printing money on a fairly large scale on the West Coast, Bill said, and they want him to begin doing the same thing here. I understand now why the economic status of the organization seems to have improved so much in the last year. Actually, since we switched to large-scale actions, we've been tapping some new sources of contributions, mostly fat cats buying insurance, I suspect, but we are apparently still finding it useful to print some of our own money. Whatever genius is running our West Coast counterfeiting operation made up a very thorough set of instructions, which Bill showed me. The guy must have worked for the Secret Service or the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. He really seems to know his business. At this point is inserted another note to the reader. The Bureau of Engraving and Printing was the government agency which produced paper money in the United States, and the Secret Service was a police agency which combated counterfeiting, among other things. As we know, counterfeiting was later used by the organization not only to supply its units with funds, but also to disrupt the general economy. In the last days of the Great Revolution, the organization was dumping such huge quantities of counterfeit money that the government, in desperation, outlawed all paper money, requiring all monetary transactions to take place either in coin or by check. This move played havoc with public morale and was one of the factors leading to the final success of the revolution. Now the text continues. Bill has already finished setting up nearly everything. He has a really fine shop for precision printing. He just needs help with the fluorescence problem. The instructions tell him what chemical additives to put in his ink, but not where to get them. And he is not sure about how to make and use an ultraviolet inspection unit for checking the finished product. That won't be hard. Our new working and living arrangement is radically different from the one we had before. Instead of sneaking around underground, we are right out in the open now. There's a neon sign in the window of the printing shop, and it's listed in the yellow pages. During the day, the shop is open for business, with Carol behind the counter. But Bill keeps his prices so high that just enough work to maintain appearances comes in. His real work takes place after hours, usually in the basement, where the armory is. The four of us live above the shop like we did over the old place, but we don't have to keep the windows blacked out, and Bill's pickup truck stays parked right on the street in front. So far as the world is concerned, we are just two young couples in the printing business together. The trick, of course, was in establishing false identities that would stand up to system scrutiny. But the organization has developed an admirable degree of expertise along that line. We all have social security cards, and two of us have driver's licenses. The cards and licenses are genuine. I've heard some unpleasant stories about how the organization obtained them. So we can open bank accounts, pay taxes, and do other things like anyone else. I just have to remember that my new name is David J. Bloom. I am really being ribbed about that. Fortunately, the photograph on the driver's license is indistinct enough to pass for me, so long as I keep my hair dyed. The organization had no choice about establishing new identities for all of us who are underground. A person without a documented identity simply can't function in this society any longer. One can't buy groceries or even ride a bus without showing either a driver's license or one of the new identity cards the government has begun issuing. It's still possible to get by with a fake in most cases, but the computerized system will be completed in another few months, and then fakes will automatically be detected. So the organization decided to do it right and give us genuine credentials, even though that's a slow and difficult job. A few special units handle that task with cold-blooded ruthlessness, but the demand for new credentials still far exceeds the supply. It also appears that the system has become even more ruthless in its campaign against us. A number of our people, perhaps as many as 50 for the whole country, have been murdered by professional killers in the last 4 months. It's hard to fix the exact total because some we suspect have been killed have just disappeared, and no body has been found. When our people first began to disappear or to be found floating in the river with their hands tied behind their backs and 6 or 7 bullet holes in their heads, there was a widespread assumption among the organization rank and file that these killings were internal disciplinary actions by the organization itself. In fact, there was a period last fall when we were losing more members because of disciplinary executions than anything else. That was a time when morale was very low, and it was necessary to use extreme methods to convince waverers to remain steadfast in their obligations to the organization. But it was immediately apparent to Revolutionary Command, and it soon became apparent to everyone else, that a new element had entered the picture. From our contacts inside one of the federal police agencies, we learned that our people are being killed by two groups, a special Israeli assassination squad and an assortment of mafia hitmen under contract to the government of Israel. Where both these groups are concerned, U.S. police have been given a hands-off order by the FBI. At this point, there is another editorial note inserted in the text. The Mafia was a criminal organization composed primarily of Italians and Sicilians, but usually masterminded by Jews, which flourished in the United States in the 8 decades prior to the Great Revolution. There were several half-hearted governmental efforts to stamp out the Mafia during this period, but the unrestricted capitalism then flourishing provided ideal conditions for large-scale organized crime and its concomitant political corruption. The Mafia remained in existence until virtually all its members, more than 8,000 men, were rounded up and executed in a single massive operation by the organization during the mopping-up period which followed the revolution. Here the main text resumes. All the victims so far have been among our legals. Apparently, someone in the FBI gives the names of persons suspected of being members of the organization but not yet under arrest to someone in the Israeli embassy, and they take it from there. We have made some reprisals. In New Orleans, for example, after two of our legals, one a prominent attorney there, were murdered mafia-style about 6 weeks ago, we mined the nightclub, which served as the local mafia hangout. When the bombs went off and the place burst into flames during a birthday celebration for one of their underbosses, the fleeing patrons were met with merciless hails of machine gun fire from our people, who were stationed on rooftops across from the only two exits. More than 400 persons lost their lives there that night, including approximately 60 members of the Mafia. But this new threat still remains very much with us, and it has severely damaged the morale of those of our members and partisans who are exposed to it, namely those who, by retaining their status as law-abiding citizens and operating under their own identities, do not enjoy the anonymity of us in the underground. It is clear that we will soon have to move against the source of the threat. The next entry is dated April 2nd. Supply problem solved, at least temporarily. It required another one of those stick-up operations which I really detest. I wasn't as nervous this time as when Henry and I pulled our first one. That seems half a lifetime ago. But I still didn't like it. Bill and I broke our list of needed items up into 3 categories, according to their source. About 2/3 of the chemical items we needed were not readily available on the general consumer market and would have to come from a chemical supply house. Then I wanted at least 100 wristwatches for timing devices, and they would cost us too much if we simply purchased them. Finally, there were a number of electronic and electrical components, some items of general hardware, and a few readily available chemicals, all of which could be purchased without difficulty and within the resources of our budget. I spent most of Tuesday and Wednesday gathering up the items in the last category. The chemical problem was also solved Wednesday. That had been a worry because suppliers of laboratory and industrial chemicals are now required to check out all new customers with the political police, just as are suppliers of explosives. I'd just as soon avoid that sort of scrutiny. But I checked with Washington Field Command and found that one of our legals in Silver Spring has a small electroplating shop and could order what I need from his regular supplier. I'll pick the stuff up from him Monday. But the watches. I knew exactly what I wanted for our timers, and I wanted enough of the same style so that the timers could be standardized, both for efficiency in building them and precisely known behavior in operation. So Catherine and I robbed a warehouse in Northeast D.C. yesterday and got 200 of them. It took 2 days of telephoning just to find the watches I was looking for. Then they had to be sent down to the Washington warehouse from Philadelphia. I told the man in Washington I was in a big hurry for them and would send someone out right away with a certified check for $12,000 to pick them up. He said they would be waiting for me in the front office, and they were. I wanted Bill to go with me, but he's been tied down with work at the shop all week. And Catherine really wanted to go. The girl has a wild streak in her that someone who doesn't know her well would never suspect. First, one of Catherine's makeup jobs to protect my David Bloom identity and her own. Identity under identity under identity. I've almost forgotten who Earl Turner is or what he actually looks like. Then we had to swipe a vehicle. That took only a few minutes, and we followed the usual procedure. Park the pickup in a big shopping center, walk to the other side of the parking lot, find a car which is unlocked, and get in. I used a small bolt cutter to cut the armored cable to the ignition switch under the dashboard, and then it was a matter of only a few seconds to find the right wires in the cable and attach clip leads. I had hoped there would be no violence at the warehouse, but my wish was not to be granted. We presented ourselves to the manager and asked for our package. He asked for the certified check. "I have it," I said, "and I'll give it to you as soon as I check to see that the watches are the ones I ordered." My plan was to take the watches and just walk out the door, leaving the manager yelling for his check. But when the man came back with our package, two husky warehouse workers came with him, and one took up a position between us and the door. They were taking no chances. I opened the package, checked the contents, and drew my pistol. Catherine also drew her gun, and she waved the man near the door away. But then the door would not open when she tried it. She turned her gun on the worker, and he quickly explained, "They have to push the buzzer in the office to unlock the door." I whirled back toward the manager and snarled at him, "Get this door open now, or I'll pay you for these watches with hot lead." But he nimbly ducked out another doorway from the office into the storage area and slammed a heavy metal door behind him before I could react. I then ordered the female clerk at the desk to push the buzzer for the door. She, however, continued to sit as rigidly as a statue, her mouth wide open in an expression of horror. Beginning to feel desperate, I decided to shoot the lock off the door. It took 4 shots to do it, partly because my nervous haste spoiled my aim. We ran to the car, but the warehouse manager was already there. The bastard was letting the air out of our tires. I slammed the barrel of my revolver down on his head and sent him sprawling in the gravel. Fortunately, he had only partially deflated one tire, and the car could still be driven. Catherine and I wasted no more time getting away from there. What a life! It wasn't until this afternoon, when I had finished assembling and testing the first timer, that I was convinced that the fancy watches I wanted were worth the hassle it took to get them. The new timer works perfectly. It makes a positive, low-resistance contact every time, and I'm sure that it will reduce our percentage of misfires to practically zero. I also got Bill's ultraviolet inspection unit working for him, and he will be ready to print his first greenbacks as soon as I pick up his ink additives Monday. His product won't be perfect, but it should be close enough. In particular, it should pass all the standard tests used in banks to spot counterfeit bills. They'll have to take it to a lab to tell it's phony. And I finished designing 3 different bomb mechanisms that should pass an X-ray examination without arousing suspicion. One of them fits into an umbrella handle, batteries, timer, and all. The main shaft of the umbrella can be filled with thermite if one wants an incendiary device, or the handle can be detached and used as a detonator. Another timer-detonator combination will be built into a pocket transistor radio. That one can also be fired by a tone-coded radio signal. And the third will be an electric wristwatch with the detonator and booster molded into the wristband and fired by the watch's built-in battery. In each case, of course, the bulk explosives must be brought into an area separately, but they can be disguised in many different ways. Cast like plaster, for example, into the shape of any familiar object, even painted the right color. The next diary entry is dated April 10th, 1993. This is the first time in a week I've had some time to myself and have been able to relax. I'm in a Chicago motel with nothing to do until tomorrow morning, when I'll take a tour of the Evanston Power Project. I flew out here Friday afternoon for two things, the Evanston tour and a delivery of hot money to one of our Chicago units. Bill started his press up Monday night as soon as we had mixed the chemical additives into the ink, and he kept it going almost continuously until the wee hours of Friday morning, with Carol spelling him twice for a few hours of sleep. He didn't shut down until he had used the last of the banknote paper acquired for the purpose. Catherine and I helped by doing the cutting and by handling the paper at both ends of the press. The work nearly killed all of us, but the organization wanted the money in a hurry. They really have a pile of it now. I had never dreamed of seeing so much money in my life. Bill printed just over $10 million in $10 and $20 bills, more than a ton of crisp new banknotes, and they look good. I compared one of Bill's new tens with a genuine new one, and I couldn't tell which was which except by the serial numbers. Bill really did a professional job all around. Every bill even has a different serial number. This project just shows what can be accomplished with careful planning, dedication, and hard work. Of course, Bill had 6 months to set things up and practice with dry runs before I was available to help him with the ink additives and the ultraviolet unit. He had all the bugs worked out of the process before beginning his 3.5-day run. I brought 50,000 of the new 20s with me and delivered them to my Chicago contact yesterday. His unit has the job of laundering the bills so that an equivalent amount of genuine currency will be available for the organization's expenses in this area. That's really a much trickier and more time-consuming operation than the printing. At the same time I left for here, Catherine was boarding a flight for Boston with $800,000 in her luggage. Later this week, we will be making deliveries in Dallas and Atlanta. Getting through the airport security checks with all that hot money is a little ticklish, but as long as they don't do anything other than x-ray our luggage, we'll be all right. The only things they seem to be looking for now are bombs and firearms, but just wait until they begin picking up our hot bills all across the country. I had a chance to do some thinking on the plane from Washington. From 35,000 feet, one gets a different perspective on things. Seeing all those sprawling suburbs and freeways and factories spread out below makes one realize just how big America is and what an awesomely difficult task we have undertaken. Essentially, what we are doing with our program of strategic sabotage is hastening along somewhat the natural decay of America. We are chipping away at the termite-eaten timbers of the economy, so that the whole structure will collapse a few years sooner and more catastrophically than without our efforts. It is depressing to realize what a relatively small influence all our sacrifices are having on the course of events. Consider our counterfeiting, for example. We'll have to print and distribute in a year's time at least 1,000 times as much money as Bill printed last week, at least $10 billion a year, before we will make even a barely measurable effect on the national economy. Americans spend 3 times that much just on cigarettes. Of course, we have 2 other money presses running on the West Coast, and we'll be setting up others in the near future. And if I can figure a way to take out the Evanston project, that'll be a capital loss of nearly $10 billion in one stroke, not to mention the economic damage which will result from the loss of electrical power to industrial plants throughout the Great Lakes region. But we are doing something else which is really more important than our campaign against the system. In the long run, it will be infinitely more important. We are forging the nucleus of a new society, a whole new civilization, which will rise from the ashes of the old. And it's because our new civilization will be based on an entirely different worldview than the present one, that it can only replace the other in a revolutionary manner. There is no way a society based on Aryan values and an Aryan outlook can evolve peacefully from a society which has succumbed to Jewish spiritual corruption. Thus, our present struggle is unavoidable, completely aside from the fact that it was forced on us by the system and was not of our choosing. Looking at the events of the past 31 months from this viewpoint, that is, considering our constructive task of building a new social nucleus rather than our purely destructive war against the system, It appears to me that our initial strategy of hitting system leaders instead of the general economy was not really as bad a way to start as I had thought. It shaped the character of the battle from the beginning as us versus the system, rather than us versus the economy. The system responded repressively to protect itself from our attacks, and this caused it to isolate itself to a certain extent from the public. When we weren't doing much but assassinating congressmen, federal judges, secret policemen, and media masters, the people themselves did not feel especially threatened, but they resented the inconveniences caused by all the system's new security measures. If we had hit the economy from the beginning, the system could have more easily painted the struggle as one of us versus the people, and it would have been easier for the media to convince the public of the necessity of collaborating with the system against a common menace, namely us. So our initial error in strategy has providentially made it easier for us to recruit now, when we are deliberately working to make things as uncomfortable for everyone as we can. And it isn't just the organization which has been doing a lot of recruiting lately. The order is also growing at a rate unprecedented in the last 48 of its nearly 68 years of existence. I surreptitiously made the sign when I met our pickup man here yesterday, as I always do when I meet new organization members now, and I was pleasantly surprised when he responded in kind. He invited me to be a guest at an induction ceremony last night for new probationary members in the Chicago area. I gladly accepted, and I was astounded to count approximately 60 persons at the ceremony, nearly a third of whom were inductees. That's more than three times the total number of members the order has in the Washington area. I was nearly as moved by the ceremony as I was by my own induction a year and a half ago. The next diary entry is dated April 14th. Problems, problems, problems. Nothing has gone right since I got back from Chicago. Bill can't find any more of the paper he used for the last batch of money, and he asked me to help him improvise. We tried tinting some slightly off-color paper of the same basic texture and composition, but the result was unsatisfactory. Bill will keep looking for another supply of the original paper while I continue trying different tinting processes. Then there was the delegation from the local Human Relations Council, which visited the shop yesterday. Four blacks and a sick, sick, sick white male, all wearing council armbands, came into the print shop. They wanted to put a big poster in the shop window, the same kind one sees everywhere now, urging citizens to help fight racism by reporting suspicious persons to the political police and leave a container for donations on the counter. Carol was behind the counter at the time, and she told them, in effect, to go to hell. That, of course, wasn't the right thing to do under the circumstances. They would have reported us to the political police if I hadn't heard the commotion and intervened. I came up the basement stairs with what I hoped was a convincingly Jewish expression on my face and went into a, "So what's going on here already?" routine. I laid it on thick, not too thick, I hope, so they would get the message. The shop manager here was himself a member of a minority group, a very special minority group, and could hardly be suspected of harboring any hostility for the Human Relations Council's or their commendable efforts. The head nigger began complaining indignantly to me about Carol's rebuff. I cut him off with an impatient wave of my hand and directed a look of mock shock at Carol. Of course, I said. Leave your collection box here. It's for a good cause. But no window poster. Not enough room. I wouldn't even let my cousin Abe put one of his United Jewish Appeal posters there. Come, I show you where." As I officiously led the delegation toward the door, I ordered Carol back to work in my best Simon Legree manner. "Yes, Mr. Bloom," she said meekly. Out on the sidewalk, I overcame my revulsion while I chummily put an arm around the shoulders of the black spokesman and directed his attention to a store directly across the street. "We don't have so many customers here," I explained. But my good friend Sally Feinstein has many people going in and out, and he has a big window. He will be happy for your poster to be there. You can put it right under where it says Saul's Pawn Shop, and everybody will see it. And be sure to leave him a donation box, two donation boxes. He has a big store. They all seemed pleased by my friendly suggestion and started across the street. But the white, a sorry-looking specimen with pimples and an imitation afro, hesitated, turned, and said to me, "Maybe we ought to get that girl's name. Some of the things she said to us sounded definitely racist." "Don't waste your time on her," I responded brusquely, dismissing his suspicion with a wave. "She is just a dumb shiksa. She talks that way to everybody. I get rid of her soon." When I re-entered the shop, Bill, who had overheard the episode from the basement stairs, and Carol were convulsed with laughter. "It's not really that funny," I admonished them with an effort at sternness. I had to do something right away, and if my pucker and my phony accent hadn't fooled that crew of subhumans, we'd be in real trouble now. Then I lectured Carol. "We can't afford the luxury of telling these creatures what we think of them. We have a job to do first, and then we'll settle with that bunch once and for all. So let's swallow our pride and play along as we have to. Those who don't have our responsibilities can get themselves investigated for racism if they want, and more power to them." But I could not repress a grin when I saw the poster go into place in the pawn shop window across the street, blotting out most of Saul's display of used cameras and binoculars. He must really have had to bite his tongue. And now all the people who see that particular poster will make the correct mental association between the council's thought control program and the people behind it. The last thing to go wrong was Catherine coming down with the flu last night. She was scheduled to take a load of money to Dallas this morning, but she was too sick to go, and it looks like she'll be in bed for another 2 or 3 days, which means that I'll be stuck not only with a trip to Atlanta tomorrow, but I'll also have to make the Dallas delivery. That'll be a whole day wasted on planes and at airports, and I need the time badly for getting ready for the Evanston operation. We want to hit the new nuclear power complex at Evanston during the next 6 weeks, while they're still guiding tourists through it. After the 1st of June, when it will be closed to the public permanently, knocking it out will become much more difficult. The Evanston Power Project is an enormous thing. 4 huge nuclear reactors surrounded by the biggest turbines and generators in the world. And the whole thing sits on concrete pilings a mile out in Lake Michigan, which supplies the cooling water for the reactor's heat exchangers. The project generates 18,000 megawatts of electric power, almost 20 billion watts. Incredible. The power is fed into the power grid, which supplies the entire Great Lakes region. Before the Evanston project went into operation 2 months ago, the whole Midwest was suffering from a severe power shortage, much worse than we have here, which is bad enough. In some areas, factories were restricted to operating only 2 days a week, and there were so many unexpected blackouts in addition that the region was on the verge of a real economic crisis. If we can take out the new power plant, things will be even worse than they were before. In order to keep the lights on in Chicago and Milwaukee, the authorities will have to steal power from as far away as Detroit and Minneapolis, where there is none to spare. All of that part of the country will be hit hard, and it took 10 years to design and build the Evanston project, so they won't be able to remedy the situation very soon. But the government has thought about the consequences of losing the Evanston project, too, and the security there is pretty formidable. One can't get near the place except by boat or airplane. And there are searchlights, patrol boats, and strings of buoys with nets of cable between them all around it, which makes the approach by water almost out of the question. The shore, for miles in either direction, is fenced off, and there are a number of military radar and anti-aircraft installations behind the fence, making any attempt to crash an airplane loaded with explosives into the plant very unlikely to succeed. It seems to me that about the only way we could mount an attack on the place by conventional means would be to sneak some heavy mortars within range, somewhere near the shore where there is a possibility for concealment. But to my knowledge, we don't have that kind of weaponry available at the moment. Anyway, the really vital parts of the power station are in such massive buildings that I doubt a mortar attack could inflict more than superficial damage. So Revolutionary Command asked me to tour the place and come up with some unconventional ideas, which I have done, but there are still several tough problems to be solved. My visit there last Monday gave me a pretty good idea of the strengths and weaknesses of the security arrangements. Some of the weaknesses are really quite astounding. Most astounding of all is the government's decision to let tourists into the place, even temporarily. The reason for that decision, I am sure, is the big fuss the anti-nuclear crazies have been making about the plant. The government feels obliged to show the public all the safety features which have been built into it. When I signed up for the tour, I deliberately loaded myself down with all sorts of paraphernalia just to see what I could get into the plant. I carried an attaché case, a camera, and an umbrella, and I filled my pockets with coins, keys, and mechanical pencils. On the ferry boat, which takes tourists out to the plant, there is very little security. They merely made me open my attaché case for a cursory inspection. But when I got into the guard station at the plant itself, they divested me of my case, camera, and umbrella. Then I had to walk through a metal detector, which picked up all the metal junk in my pockets. I emptied my pockets for the guards, but then they handed the stuff back to me. They didn't look closely at any of it, so one can at least sneak an incendiary pencil in. What really interested me, though, was that one old gentleman in my group was carrying a cane with a metal head, and the guards let him keep it during the tour. In essence, my idea is this. Since there's no way a single tourist can sneak in enough explosive material to wreck the place, nor any way he can position the small amount he could sneak in so it would be really effective, like punching a hole in one of the reactor pressure vessels, we may as well forget about explosives. Instead, we'll try to contaminate the plant with radioactive material so that it can't be used. What makes the idea feasible is that we have a source inside the organization for certain radioactive materials. He's a chemistry professor at a university in Florida, and he uses the materials for his research. We can easily pack enough of a really hot and nasty radionuclide, something with a half-life of a year or so, into a cane or a crutch, together with a small explosive charge for dispersing it, to make the entire Evanston Power Project uninhabitable. The plant won't be damaged physically, but they'll have to shut it down. Decontamination will be such an enormous task that the plant may very well stay closed permanently. Unfortunately, this will be a suicide mission. Whoever carries the radioactive material into the plant will already have been exposed to a lethal dose of radiation before he gets to the plant gate with it. There's just no practical way to provide any shielding. The biggest worry is the radiation detectors, which are all over the plant. If one of those gets a whiff of our man before he's ready to do his thing, it could get sticky. I noticed, however, no detectors in the entrance station of the plant, where the guards check the incoming tourists. There are several in the huge turbine and generator room where the tourists are taken, and there is one beside the exit gate used by the tourists, presumably to guard against the unlikely event of a visitor somehow pocketing a piece of nuclear fuel and trying to sneak it out. But it seems not to have occurred to them that someone might try to sneak radioactive material into the plant. I remember pretty well where all the detectors are, and I'll have to consult with our man in Florida on the likelihood of one of them picking up something at a given distance from the material he will supply us. If an alarm goes off after our carrier is in the plant, but before he gets to the generator room, he'll just have to make a run for it. But we'll try to design our gadget so as to give him the best possible chance. The whole plan is pretty scary, but it has one big advantage, the psychological impact on the public. People are almost superstitious in their fear of nuclear radiation. The anti-nuclear lobby will have a field day with it. It will catch people's imagination to a far greater extent than any ordinary bombing or mortar attack. It will horrify many people, and it will knock more of them off the fence. I must confess that I'm glad at this point that my probationary period still has 11 months to run and that I won't be asked to volunteer for this particular mission. The next diary entry is dated April 20th, 1993. A beautiful day, a day of rest and peace after a hectic week. Catherine and I drove to the mountains early this morning and spent the day walking in the woods. It was cool and bright and clear. After a picnic lunch, we made love in a little meadow under the open sky. We talked of many things, and we were both happy and carefree. The only shadow which fell on our happiness was Catherine's complaint about the number of out-of-town trips the organization has sent me on recently, even though I've been out of prison for less than a month. I didn't have the courage to tell her that in the future we will have even less time together. I only found that out myself yesterday. When I reported to Major Williams last night after returning from Florida, he told me that I'll be traveling a lot in the next few months. I didn't get all the details from him, but he hinted that the organization is preparing for an all-out nationwide offensive this summer, and I am to be a sort of roving military engineer. But today I put that out of my mind and just enjoyed being alive and free and alone with a lovely girl in the midst of nature's beauty. As we were driving home this evening, we heard the news on the radio which capped a perfect day. The organization hit the Israeli embassy in Washington this afternoon. No better date in the year could have been chosen for such an action. For months, an Israeli murder squad, working out of their embassy, has been picking off our people around the country. Today, we settled the score for the moment. We struck with heavy mortars while the Israelis were throwing a cocktail party for their obedient servants in the U.S. Senate. A number of Israeli officials had flown in for the occasion, and there must have been more than 300 people in the embassy when our 4.2-inch mortars began raining TNT and phosphorus onto their heads through the roof. The attack only lasted 2 or 3 minutes, according to the news report, but more than 40 projectiles struck the embassy, leaving nothing but a burned-out heap of wreckage, and only a handful of survivors. So we must have had at least 2 mortars firing. That confirms what I was told last week about our new weapons acquisitions. One fascinating incident in the news story, which the censors somehow failed to cut out before it was broadcast, was the murder of a group of tourists by an embassy guard. During the attack, an Israeli came running out of the crumbling building with a submachine gun, his clothing in flames. He spotted a group of a dozen tourists, all women and small children, gawking at the scene of destruction from across the street. Shrieking out his hatred in guttural Hebrew, the Jew opened fire on them, killing 9 on the spot and critically wounding 3 others. Of course, he was not charged by the police. Your day is coming, Jews. Your day is coming. I should be getting to bed early tonight in order to be ready for a long day tomorrow, but the excitement of our achievement this afternoon makes it impossible for me to sleep yet. The organization has demonstrated once again what an incomparable weapon the mortar is for guerrilla warfare. I am much more enthusiastic now about our new plan for Evanston, and I'll be better braced for overcoming any more balkanness on the part of our professor in Florida. Last Saturday, when I was discussing my plan for getting radioactive material into the Evanston plant with Henry and Ed Sanders, they convinced me that a mortar could do the job better, and that we are now well supplied in that department. So I redesigned the delivery package, changing it from a walking cane to a 4.2-inch mortar projectile. We will replace the phosphorus in 3 white phosphorus rounds with our radioactive contaminant. After we have zeroed in the target with conventional rounds, we'll fire our 3 modified projectiles, which will be adjusted to exactly the same weight, of course. This way of doing it has 3 advantages over my original plan. First, it is surer. There is much less chance of something going wrong. Second, we will be delivering approximately 10 times as much contaminant, and the bursting charges and the projectiles will disperse it better than anything we could hope for with a loaded walking cane. And third, it need not be a suicide mission. We can keep the hot projectiles shielded until the moment they are to be fired, so the mortar crew will not be exposed to a lethal dose of radiation. My big worry was whether we would be able to get our projectiles inside the power station instead of just on the roof. The building is so heavily constructed that I doubt they would penetrate, even with delayed action fuses. Ed Sanders convinced me, though, that once a 4.2-incher is zeroed in and firmly seated, it will deliver rounds with sufficient accuracy and a low enough trajectory so that we will have an excellent hit probability on the side of the generator building facing the shore, which is practically one huge window, 10 stories high and more than 200 yards wide. Armed with this new plan, I went to talk to Harrison, our Florida chemist. I explained to him that his part of the job is to procure a suitable radioactive material and then, using his special facilities, safely load it into the mortar projectiles I will bring him. Harrison had a fit. He complained that he had only offered to supply the organization with small quantities of radionuclides and other hard-to-obtain materials. He did not want to become involved in actually handling any ordnance, and he especially objected to the quantity of material required by our plan. Not many people in the country have access to so much radioactive material, and he is afraid it will be traced to him. I tried reasoning with him. I explained that if we tried to load the projectiles ourselves without the shielded handling facilities he has, one or more of our people will surely be exposed to a lethal dose of radiation. And I told him that he is free to choose a radionuclide or a mixture of radionuclides, which will cast the least suspicion on him, so long as it is suitable for our purpose. But he flatly refused. "It's out of the question," he said. "It would jeopardize my entire career." "Dr. Harrison," I replied, "I'm afraid you don't understand the situation. We are at war. The future of our race depends upon the outcome of this war. As a member of the organization, you are obliged to put your responsibility to our common effort ahead of all personal considerations. You are subject to the organization's discipline." Harrison turned white and began stammering, but I continued relentlessly. "If you continue to refuse my request, I am prepared to kill you on the spot." As a matter of fact, I was unarmed because I had flown down on a commercial airliner. But Harrison didn't know that. He swallowed a couple of times, found his voice, and said he will do what he can. We went over our figures and our requirements again and settled on an approximate timetable. Before I left, I assured Harrison that if he feels this operation will place him in too much jeopardy to continue as a legal, we can bring him underground after it is completed. He is obviously still very nervous and unhappy, but I don't think he will try to betray us. The organization has established a very high degree of credibility for its threats. Just to be on the safe side, however, we will use another courier when the time comes to drive the modified projectiles down to Florida to be loaded and brought back. No technical knowledge is required for that. I don't like to act like a tough guy and threaten people. That is an unnatural role for me. But I have very little sympathy for people like Harrison, and I am sure that if he had not agreed to cooperate, I would have leaped on him and strangled him with my bare hands. I guess there are a lot of other people who think they are playing it smart by looking out for themselves and letting us take all the risks and do all the dirty work. They figure that they will reap the benefits with us if we win, and they won't lose anything if we lose. That's the way it has been in most other wars and revolutions, but I don't believe it will work out that way this time. Our attitude is that those whose only concern is to enjoy life in these times of trial for our race do not deserve life. Let them die. In the conduct of this war, we certainly will not concern ourselves with looking out for their welfare. More and more, it will be a case of either being for us all the way or against us. The next diary entry is dated April 25th. Off to New York tomorrow for at least a week. Several things cooking up there which require my attention. The business down in Florida should have been taken care of by the time I return, and if so, it'll be another trip to Chicago for me, this time by car. The Yids are really screaming about the attack on their embassy. They are giving far more emphasis in the news media to this attack than they did to either the attack on the Capitol or the bombing of the FBI building. Each day on TV it gets worse, with more and more of the old gas chamber propaganda that has worked so well for them in the past. They are really pulling their hair and rending their garments. Oy vey, how we are suffering, how we are persecuted, why did you let it happen to us? Weren't 6 million enough? What an act of outraged innocence. They are so good at it that they almost have me weeping along with them. But, strangely, there has not been another mention of the murder of those 9 tourists by the Israeli guard. Ah, well, they were only Gentiles. One unexpected benefit to us from the embassy action has been a major quarrel between the blacks and their Jewish patrons. Purely by coincidence, the attack came 3 days before the date, which had been set for a nationwide strike for equality, another of those giant media affairs to be stage-managed by the human relations councils, in which spontaneous demonstrations were to be held simultaneously in a number of large cities, with black and white citizens joining together in a call for the government to break down the last of the barriers between the races and assure the blacks of full equality. But then, last Thursday, the day after we hit the Israelis, the big boys in the councils, Jews of course, called it all off. They decided that they can't afford to share the media spotlight with the blacks until they have finished milking their own martyrdom in the embassy raid for all it is worth. A few of the more militant black leaders, who spent a long time working on the preparations for the equality strike, didn't see it that way. They have long resented the high-handed way in which the Jews manipulate and exploit the entire equality movement for their own ends, and this was the last straw for some of them. There were angry accusations and counter-accusations, which culminated Saturday in the Jews' number one house nigger, the nominal chairman of the National Association of Human Relations Councils, giving a press interview at which he denounced his Jewish masters. From now on, he said, the Human Relations Councils will not recognize the Jewish claim to minority status. They will be treated just like the white majority and will no longer be exempt from investigation and punishment for racism. He was out on his ear before he knew what happened, of course, and his place has been taken by a better housebroken black. But the fat is already in the fire. On the streets, the roving bands of black deputies have gotten the word, and woe betide any member of the self-chosen tribe who falls into their hands. Several have already died while being questioned just in the last 2 days. The Toms will eventually get their more militant and resentful brethren back into line. But meanwhile, Izzy and Sambo are really at one another's throats, tooth and nail, and it is a joy to behold. The next diary entry is dated May 6th. It's nice to be home again, even if only for a day. But New York was interesting. I saw more ordnance up there than I ever imagined we'd have at our disposal. One of our specialized units in New York has been acquiring military materiel of all sorts and stockpiling it. The purpose of my visit was to survey the types of military gadgets available, which might be useful to me in designing and building special weapons and sabotage devices, so that I can make recommendations for future procurement priorities. I was met at the airport by a girl who drove me to a wholesale plumbing supply store in an incredibly filthy industrial and warehouse area in Queens, near the East River. Garbage, old newspapers, and empty liquor bottles were strewn all over. We had to navigate around the stripped and rusting hulks of several abandoned autos, which nearly blocked the narrow street before the girl finally pulled into a small, muddy parking area behind a tall chain-link fence. She knocked at a steel door marked Employees Only, and we were quickly admitted to a gloomy, dusty storeroom filled with bins of pipe fittings. There she turned me over to a cheerful young man, about 25 years old, dressed in greasy coveralls and carrying a clipboard. He introduced himself only as Richard and offered me a cup of coffee from a disreputable-looking electric urn at one end of a long counter near the door. Then we took an old and rickety freight elevator to the second floor of the building. When we stepped out of the elevator, I gasped in surprise. In a huge, low-ceilinged room, more than 100 feet on a side, there were immense heaps of every sort of military weaponry imaginable. Automatic rifles, machine guns, flamethrowers, mortars, and literally thousands of cases of ammunition, grenades, explosives, detonators, boosters, and spare parts. I don't know how the floor supported it all. In one corner of the room, four men and a woman worked at two long benches under fluorescent lights. One man was grinding the serial numbers off automatic rifles, which he took one at a time from a stack of approximately 50, while the others oiled and reassembled the rifles, and then carefully packed them inside a large hot water heater from which the top had been removed. I saw a dozen large cartons nearby which contained other water heaters. "That's the way we store and ship the weapons," Richard explained. "We remove the serial numbers just to make it harder for the authorities to figure out where we're getting the stuff in case they ever find any of it. And once the water heaters leave here, there's no way they can be traced back to us. The phony shipping tags we put on the cartons are coded to tell us what the contents are. You'll find out that our rather special water heaters have been installed in the headquarters of quite a few of our combat units along the East Coast, but we ship them everywhere in the country." Almost in a daze, I wandered among the heaps of weaponry. I stopped beside a ceiling-high stack of large, olive-drab crates. Stenciled on each crate were the words, "Mortar 4.2 inch, M30, complete." And under that, "Gross weight, 700 pounds. "Where did you get these?" I asked. I remembered all the work we had done a year and a half ago modifying just one mortar of ancient vintage. "These came in last week from Fort Dix," Richard answered. "The people in one of our units just outside Trenton paid a black supply sergeant on the base $10,000 to swipe a truck with those things on it and deliver it to them. Then they brought them up here, two at a time, in the back of a pickup. We receive materiel here from more than a dozen bases and arsenals in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. Look what we got last month from Picatinny Arsenal," he said, throwing back a tarpaulin covering a nearby stack of cylindrical objects. I leaned over to examine them. They were fiberboard tubes about 2 feet long and 5 inches in diameter. Each one contained an M329 high-explosive mortar projectile. There must have been at least 300 of them in that one pile. Richard continued his explanation. "It used to be that most of our new weapons were smuggled off military bases one at a time by our own people who were stationed there. But lately we've switched to hiring black service personnel to hijack the stuff for us by the truckload. We don't always get exactly what we want that way, but we get a lot more of it. We've set up a couple of phony fronts posing as mafia buyers for the illegal weapons exporting business. Our people on the bases steer the buyers to blacks in charge of the weapons storage areas. For enough money, they'll walk off with the whole base for us. They just have to share some of the money we give them with a few of their soul brothers on guard duty. There are several advantages for us. First, it's easier for the blacks to swipe the stuff without getting caught. The political police aren't watching them as closely as they are the white service personnel. And the blacks already have organized networks on all of the bases for siphoning off and selling tires, gasoline, PX supplies, and other things for which there is a civilian demand. And it allows our people in the service to concentrate on their main task, which is recruiting other white servicemen and building our strength inside the military. I spent the rest of the day going through everything in the room and mentally cataloging it. When I left, I took samples of a couple dozen different types of high-explosive fuses, igniters, and other odds and ends I wanted to experiment with, which meant I had to come back on the train. The situation in the military is double-edged. With more than 40% blacks in the Army, and nearly that many in the other services, morale, discipline, and efficiency are shockingly low. That makes it enormously easier for us to steal weapons and also to recruit, especially among the career personnel who resent what has been done to their services. But it also poses a fearful danger in the long run, because the day will come when we must make our move inside the military. With so many blacks under arms, there is bound to be a bloody shambles. While we are cleaning out the blacks and reorganizing the services, the country will be virtually defenseless. Well, I guess it has been planned that way. The next diary entry is dated May 23, 1993. This is my last night in Dallas. I've been here 2 weeks now, and I'd hoped to be heading back to Washington tomorrow, but orders came in this afternoon to go to Denver instead. It looks like I'll be doing approximately the same thing there I've been doing here, which is teaching. I've just finished conducting a crash course in the technology of sabotage for 8 selected activists here, and I do mean crash. This is the first free hour I've had since I arrived here when I wasn't too tired to think. We've been at it from 8 in the morning until 8 at night every day, with only a few minutes off for meals. I've taught the people here virtually everything I know. We started by learning how to build improvised detonators, timers, igniters, and other gadgets from scratch. Then we studied the structure, properties, and performance characteristics of currently available military devices, which can be adapted for various purposes. All my students can now disassemble and reassemble every type of fuse and delay device we studied, blindfolded. After that, we examined a large number of hypothetical targets and worked out detailed plans for attacking them. We considered reservoirs, pipelines, fuel depots, rail lines, air terminals and aircraft, telephone exchanges, oil refineries, power transmission lines, generating stations, highway interchanges, grain elevators, warehouses, and various types of machinery and other manufacturing equipment. Finally, we picked a real target and destroyed it. Dallas's Central Telephone Exchange. That was yesterday. Today we held a post-mortem and criticized the operation in detail. Actually, everything went extraordinarily well. My students all passed their final examination with flying colors. But I did everything possible to guarantee there would be no slip-ups. We spent 3 full days preparing specifically for the telephone exchange. First, we thoroughly pumped one of our local members who had formerly worked in the building as an operator. She described the layout for us, giving us the approximate location of the rooms on each floor which held the automatic switching equipment. With her help, we made a rough map showing the stairwells, the employees' entrances, the guard room, and other pertinent details. Then we prepared our equipment. I decided we would use surgical precision on this job rather than brute force. Besides, we didn't have a sufficiently large quantity of explosives for a brute force demolition job. What we did have were 3 500-foot spools of PETN-filled detonating cord and a little over 20 pounds of dynamite. I broke our 8 activists up into 4 two-man teams. One man in each team carried a sawed-off auto-loading shotgun, and the other carried demolition equipment. 3 of the teams were assigned to the 3 floors of switching equipment, one to a floor. Each of these teams was given one of the spools of detonating cord, a 5-gallon can of homemade napalm-like mixture of gasoline and liquid soap, and a delayed-action detonator. The 4th team was given a 20-pound satchel charge and a homemade thermite grenade and assigned to the transformer vault in the basement. The dynamite would wreck the transformers, and the thermite would set the transformer oil afire. About 10 o'clock last night, we were parked in 2 automobiles on a dark side street 2 blocks from the telephone exchange. Every few minutes, a telephone company service truck went through the intersection directly in front of us. Finally, the situation for which we had been waiting occurred. A service truck came to a stop for the red light at the intersection, and there were no other vehicles or pedestrians in sight. We sped out of the side street, blocking the truck fore and aft, while two of our men jerked open the truck doors and ordered the driver into the back at gunpoint. Then we drove all three vehicles back onto the side street and transferred everyone and all our gear into the service truck. That only took a few seconds, but we spent another half hour talking to the telephone serviceman we had kidnapped. With a minimum of prodding, he answered a number of questions we still had about the location and layout of the switching equipment in the telephone building and about the security staff and procedures. We were pleasantly surprised to learn that there was only one armed guard in the building at night, and that he depended upon a direct line to the police substation 5 blocks away for backup in case of emergency. We relieved the serviceman of his uniform and his magnetically coded company security badge, which was needed to unlock the rear employee's entrance at night. Then we tied him securely with wire, gagged him, and drove the truck back to the rear entrance of the telephone building. I was wearing the uniform. Following the serviceman's instructions, I gained entrance to the building while the others remained hidden in the truck. It was then only a matter of a moment to relieve the surprised guard of his gun and beckon to the others to enter. While our four teams fanned out through the building, I found a convenient janitor's closet and used the guard's own master key to lock him in it. From that point, the whole operation took less than 5 minutes. The three teams assigned to the switching equipment worked quickly and efficiently, while the man with the shotgun on each floor herded any employees that were encountered into an office and kept an eye on them, the other man went to work on the equipment. The detonating cord was unreeled and laced through two or three long banks of electronic panels on each floor. Then the demolition man took the 5-gallon can of napalm and sloshed its contents over large sections of the equipment, both those which had been laced with the detonating cord and those which had not. Finally, a time-delayed detonator was taped to one end of the detonating cord. As our men came racing down the stairs to join me on the ground floor, three deafening explosions rocked the windowless building. A moment later, our fourth team came racing up the stairs from the basement. We wasted no time in piling back into the truck. Just as we drove out of the parking lot, the satchel charge went off in the basement transformer vault with a roar which caused a huge section of the brick facade on one side of the building to split off and topple into the street, exposing the interior, which by now was filled with flames and smoke from the blazing napalm and burning switching gear. The accounts of the operation in this afternoon's local newspaper indicated that the 24 or so employees who were in the building managed to get out safely, all except the guard I locked in the closet, who died of smoke inhalation. I feel guilty about that, but it couldn't be helped. We were in a hurry. Although our destruction of the equipment in the telephone building was pretty thorough, the telephone company has announced that it expects to have most essential telephone lines back in service within 48 hours and complete restoration of telephone service for the city within 2 weeks. That announcement did not surprise us. We knew that the telephone company can fly in new equipment and teams of repair specialists to quickly undo the damage we did. Our attack on the telephone exchange would only make real sense as a blow against the system if it had been coordinated with an all-out assault on a number of other fronts. The system has figured that out for itself, of course. And not having any way of knowing that yesterday's operation was only a training exercise, it is bracing itself for the worst. There are tanks at nearly every downtown intersection, and troops and police have set up so many vehicle checkpoints on all the main roads and freeways that automobile traffic is at a virtual standstill throughout the city. If it weren't for that, I'd be leaving for Denver tonight instead of tomorrow. The next diary entry is dated June 8th. Received a note from Catherine today. It came enclosed in a box of equipment I had asked the organization to have sent to me from the shop back home. I didn't discover the note until I unpacked the box, and so there was no chance to send a reply with the courier who made the delivery. She and the others have all been working 70 to 80 hours a week in the shop, she reports, printing money mostly, but also large quantities of propaganda leaflets. She suspects, from the urgency with which the leaflets have been requested, that a major new campaign is afoot in the Washington area. She'll find out what's afoot soon enough. She thinks I am still in Dallas, and she says she is hoping she will be ordered to make another cash delivery to Dallas soon so that she can see me. How my heart aches to be with her again, even if only for a few hours. There's not much chance of my getting back to Washington again for at least another 3 weeks, though. Things have really mushroomed out here in the Rocky Mountain area. The organization is not particularly strong here, and yet Revolutionary Command has designated 43 high-priority targets in the area, more than half of them military installations, which we must prepare ourselves to hit simultaneously when the order is given, probably early in July. On top of that, there is practically no one out here with any experience in specialized ordnance, so I'm having to train everyone from scratch, 26 students altogether. They'll have the responsibility for preparing and using all the incendiary and explosive devices required for the assigned targets in the area. Fortunately, we do have several military people here with an excellent grasp of guerrilla tactics, and so I'm restricting my training to the technical end only and leaving the tactics to the military people. Despite the narrower scope of my work here, it's still going more slowly than in Dallas because things are so spread out. It was deemed inadvisable to try to hold classes for 26 people at a time. So I meet with 6 here in Denver, 11 in Boulder, a college town about 20 miles north of here, and 9 in a farmhouse just south of here. I see each group every third day, but I give them plenty of homework to do between meetings. We've initiated virtually no violent actions against the system in the Rocky Mountain area so far, and the general atmosphere here is quite a bit more relaxed than along the East Coast. Something very unpleasant happened last week, though, which serves as a grim reminder that the struggle here will be just as brutal and vicious as anywhere else. One of our members, a construction worker, was caught trying to sneak a few sticks of dynamite off the construction site where he was employed. Apparently, he had been smuggling a dozen or so out in his lunchbox every day for quite a while. The site guard turned him over to the local sheriff, who immediately searched the man's house and found not only a big cache of dynamite, but also several guns and some organization literature. The sheriff figured he had stumbled onto something which could really give a big boost to his career. If he could crack the organization in the Rocky Mountain area, the system would be very grateful to him. He would have a good chance of winning a seat in the state legislature, perhaps even becoming lieutenant governor or being appointed to some other high post in the state government. So the sheriff and his deputies began beating our man, trying to make him name other organization members. They gave him a vicious working over, but he wouldn't talk. Then they brought in the man's wife and began slapping and kicking her around in his presence. The outcome was that our man, in desperation, snatched a revolver from the holster of one of the deputies. He was shot dead by another deputy before he could pull the trigger. The wife was handed over to the FBI and flown back to Washington for interrogation. She should not be able to give them any significant information, but I shudder to think of the ordeal to which she is being submitted. The sheriff's glory was short-lived, however. The evening of the day our member was killed, the sheriff appeared in a televised news interview, boasting of the blow he had struck in the name of law, order, and equality, and pompously warning that he would treat with equal ruthlessness any other racists who fell into his hands.